Yes, Your Honor. If I could reserve 2 minutes, I would appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. I'm Stephen Larson on behalf of the Mosifer plaintiffs, counter-defendants, and cross-appellees, collectively the Mosifer parties. Your Honor, obviously any questions that the court has, I'll stop immediately, but I'd like to begin with the anti-SLAPP motion that the district court, we believe, erroneously granted adverse to our clients. And specifically, the issue is that the district court erred in granting the anti-SLAPP by requiring the Mosifer plaintiffs to introduce evidence to invoke the illegal conduct exception at step one of the anti-SLAPP analysis. It's well established in California law that we have this two-step process for anti-SLAPP. It's well established that the anti-SLAPP statute itself excludes illegal conduct. While it's a broad statute and it covers a lot, what it does exclude is illegal conduct. And I don't even think the appellees in this case are challenging that the FARA statute. It's a criminal statute, and this isn't just illegal conduct. This is specifically criminal conduct. That is not protected by the anti-SLAPP statute. We have alleged in our complaint, and we alleged at length in our complaint, that the conduct was not just illegal, but it was criminal. It was in violation of the FARA statute. So then the question becomes, what standard should be applied at the anti-SLAPP stage, both for step one and for step two? What the district court did is took the Flatley case from California, and essentially imposed on the plaintiffs, both at step one and step two, an obligation to produce evidence. This court now has repeatedly held, most recently in the case that we provided with supplemental authority, that not only is that not required, but that it's expressly improper. The case that we submitted after the filing of the reply briefs, the gun case, I'm sorry, the gun versus Drage, the court of appeals, this court specifically held that, quote, this is at page 1120, we clarified that to eliminate conflicts between California's anti-SLAPP laws, procedural provisions, and the federal rules of civil procedure, courts must review anti-SLAPP motions to strike under different standards depending on the motion's basis. The court goes on, if a defendant moves to strike on purely legal arguments, which is exactly what the cases we have here, this was not a motion for summary judgment, this was not a motion to attack the facts, courts must analyze the motion under Rules 8 and 12. But where a defendant asserts a factual challenge, courts must treat the motion to strike as a motion for summary judgment triggering discovery. There was no discovery here. There was no opportunity to bring forth evidence.
The district court offered several reasons for why this wasn't covered, why the alleged illegal, unlawful prong of California's unfair competition law was not.
But what it didn't address, Judge Pius, was it didn't address the legal allegations, which by themselves were sufficient for purposes at this essential 12B stage.
Well, but I thought under California law for the unfair competition unlawful prong.
Oh, certainly, and I'm happy to go there. There's no question that there were actually six different challenges to the UCL claim, and they were all legal challenges. And so my only point, and maybe I'm belaboring the point at this point, that the anti-SLAPP was improvidently granted because it was the burden that was imposed upon the plaintiffs was to come forward with evidence of illegality. And we don't need to do that. That's clearly established by the Ninth Circuit law. The court did go after and did throw out the UCL claim, which I think was improper as well. And because we do state a valid UCL claim. And essentially there were six different reasons why the court addressed it, and threw it out. And first of all, there was this issue of the private right of action. But the California Supreme Court has expressly affirmed that the UCL provides a remedy even where the underlying statute confers no private right of action. That's just flatly wrong. In terms of the argument that we do not have standing because there's no direct harm, that too is not accurate. We we did clearly claim, and our claim is not just on the singular newspaper ad that ran in the Washington Post, which the district court cited, but rather the entire disinformation conspiracy that defendants orchestrated on behalf of the United Arab Emirates. The complaint repeatedly alleged that the disinformation conspiracy caused hundreds of millions of dollars of damage to Mossifer, and that the publications appeared to be legitimate. It was never disclosed that they were in fact propaganda. This is the whole FARA illegality aspect.
The Mossifer parties were never specifically mentioned in any of the statements, were they? In Mossifer products?
That's correct.
Were they?
They weren't, Your Honor. And that's part of the, I mean, this was a very sophisticated, very clever campaign. And what it was it was directed first and foremost at the government of Qatar. But it was designed as set forth to basically destroy Qatar and everyone who was supporting Qatar economically. And our client was in the travel business. And literally hundreds of millions of dollars were at stake in the travel, in the transportation, in the hotel. And by falsely casting Qatar as this terrorist country, this terrorist organization, this terror-ridden place, it was aimed at destroying our client's business on behalf of the UAE, which is a competitor tourist destination in the Middle East. And while it didn't mention it by name, that is not a requirement. The elements are clearly established that it is a business practice, and this was one of the other issues that the court raised, is whether or not it was a business practice. And clearly it was. It was designed to achieve the economic effect. There's no question that there's political overtones here. But just as you have a dumping case, say, out of China, for example, if China is dumping steel in the United States, that is a business practice. It may very well be that there are political reasons behind that as well. There may be geopolitical implications of it. These are not mutually exclusive. What you had here was an effort to destroy Mossifer and businesses like Mossifer to the benefit of other businesses doing business and supporting the UAE. This was clearly an economic and business effort, and that's what's alleged. Discovery may pan out differently, and that's kind of the point in how these two things are connected. We're at the 12B stage. We have clearly sufficiently alleged illegal conduct. This is a FARA violation. Mr. Broidy himself pleaded guilty in an unrelated case to a FARA violation, to a criminal case. So this is not some far-fetched notion. This is proven, demonstrated conduct, and we believe it's at work in this case here. And those are the allegations. Those are the allegations that the district court was required to treat as true and accept as true for purposes of both the anti-SLAPP motion and the 12B motion, and it failed to do so. There's also this argument that the commercial conduct is exempt from FARA. As we set forth in our briefs, FARA does not exempt individuals such as lobbyists who engage in political speech as part of a business practice. And that's what was going on here. Sure, the Washington Post ad may have been can be characterized as political speech, but the purpose of that ad, as we allege, was part of an overarching campaign of disinformation that had a clear economic/business/commercial purpose. And it's that using political lobbyists and using political instrumentalities in violation of FARA, which is the means of this unlawful business practice. And that is what triggers the appropriate application of the UCL. The court also made arguments or found persuasive this notion that there's an absolute bar to private enforcement. But if you look carefully at the case law on this, specifically the Rose versus Bank of America case out of California Supreme Court in 2013, the existence of a separate statutory enforcement scheme does not preclude a parallel action under the UCL. I think it's the Nader appellants who cite to the Heartless versus Clorox case. But the Heartless case was based on a Section 1983 action that was being used to enforce FIFRA. And the California Supreme Court has expressly addressed that. And they addressed it in the Rose case and found that the rationale does not apply to claims brought under the UCL. And these are certainly if Congress passes a statute and uses language which expressly bars any other action, that would trump certainly the UCL claim. But that's not what you have here. And the California Supreme Court has clearly indicated that those cases that the appellees are relying on in this instance do not bar it. And the final argument was that somehow that this meddles in our foreign policy, and that's certainly not the case at all. There is nothing about this lawsuit which meddles in foreign policy. There's nothing which in any way impacts foreign policy. This is a business that was targeted by the defendants in this case. It was targeted by people that the defendants were acting on behalf of, and it is all about business and economics. And the UCL claim was improperly dismissed at this stage. And I would say the same thing is true, of course, of the what was labeled as the trade libel, which is really a false statement claim. And I'll be the first to concede that it was probably imprudently labeled as a trade libel claim. But in substance and in essence, this is a classic false statement claim that is recognized under California law. We allege the elements that are required under California law. There's four of them: that there be a publication of a false statement that causes pecuniary harm to another, with three, the intent to cause harm, and four, knowledge that that statement is false. Those are the four elements, and all four elements are clearly laid out in the complaint. The complaint alleges that the defendant published a full-page advertisement in the Washington Post asserting that Qatar is a safe haven for terrorists. These false statements caused pecuniary harm to our clients. The complaint alleges that the goal of the misinformation campaign was to drive governmental and private actors away from doing business with Qatar. And lastly, the defendants knew that their statements were false. How that plays out over the course of discovery, that's what discovery is for. But at the 12B stage, those allegations are more than sufficient to establish a false statement claim under California law. So in sum on those, and I see I'm down close to 3 minutes, and I haven't even gotten to the response to their appeal. But most importantly to us at this point, the anti-SLAPP motion was just wrongly granted in this instance. Clearly the wrong standard. Both the UCL and the false statement claims are viable. They state the elements. They clearly track California law. Those should all be restored at this point. As far as the claims, we do believe that the anti-SLAPP motion was properly addressed by the district court with respect to their claims. And frankly, the abuse of process claim that they brought against us, it all comes down to that complaint. The litigation privilege, I don't need to explain to this court how the California law views the litigation privilege. It is darn near absolute, and it certainly applies to the filing of a complaint. The Virginia business conspiracy, they've conceded that two of the three parties it doesn't apply to. The third party is nothing more than another entity of Mr. Broidy, which happens to be incorporated in Virginia. Clearly, the conflicts of law analysis favors California in this. As the district court found, there's no place for this Virginia business conspiracy statute when California itself has its own business conspiracy or conspiracy statute, and the RICO is just too far afield. And the court, in each of the instances, addressed those correctly. I've got a minute and 22 seconds left. I'd like to reserve that if I could.
Well, I'll give you 2 minutes on rebuttal. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
We will next hear from Ms. Forrest for George Peter. My name is Courtney Forrest. I represent defendant appellant George Nader. Mosifer claims that the federal rules only require Mosifer to plausibly allege that defendant's comics were illegal and therefore not subject to anti-SLAPP protection. This is plainly contrary to the holdings of this court as well as the California Supreme Court, which has held that unless the conduct is conclusively shown or admitted to be illegal, the defendant is still entitled to invoke the protections of the anti-SLAPP statute. Mosifer's arguments fundamentally confuse the standards that apply to a threshold determination
of whether a narrow exception applies that bars a defendant from bringing a motion to strike at all, with the standards that apply to the evaluation of plaintiff's probability of success on its claims. And the illegal speech exception does not conflict with the federal rules because it never changes plaintiff's burden to show a reasonable probability of success on its claims. Here, Mosifer's claims are not for a violation of FARA. Their claims are for a violation of the UCL or for trade libel or injurious falsehood. So the district court properly struck those claims because the theory that Nader violated FARA was insufficient to trigger that exception, and the claims then fail as a matter of law at step two of the anti-SLAPP analysis. So the district court's order should be confirmed. Now, procedural state laws such as the anti-SLAPP are used in federal court unless doing so would present a direct collision with the federal rules of civil procedure, which was reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood. And here, there's no direct collision with respect to the illegal speech exception. The conflict only exists if plaintiff is required to produce evidence to support her claims without an opportunity for discovery. Here, that is not, the district court did not require that. Mosifer says over and over that the district court required them to produce evidence. That's not the case. They were invited to do so if that evidence exists. So if there were conclusive evidence of illegality, such as a plea agreement, a criminal fine, a conviction, that's an alternate path for the plaintiffs to defeat an anti-SLAPP motion, but it never changes their burden under the ordinary anti-SLAPP analysis. So because Nader brought only a legal challenge, they could still defeat the motion if they were able to show that their claims were sufficiently pled, which they were unable to do here. Because the illegal speech exception never increases the burden on the plaintiffs, there's no conflict here. They also argue that they were entitled to discovery under Planned Parenthood and Hearing Networks, and that's also incorrect. So plaintiffs are entitled to discovery in an anti-SLAPP analysis in two circumstances. The first is if defendants challenge the factual sufficiency of the evidence, and the second is if defendants introduce their own evidence at step one, and Nader has done neither. So Planned Parenthood and Hearing Networks hold that the plaintiffs are not required to, and indeed cannot be obligated, and are not permitted to, introduce evidence in response to purely legal challenges. The Gunn case, the Gunn v. Drage case, that they raised as supplemental authority, didn't change that analysis. That only clarified that when defendants purport to bring a legal challenge but then introduce evidence at step one in support of their prima facie showing that their conduct is constitutionally protected, that will then trigger a discovery obligation because it's essentially converting the motion to one for summary judgment. But Nader has not done that. He brings a pure legal sufficiency challenge. He has not introduced evidence at step one, and therefore plaintiffs are not entitled to discovery. No court has held, and this court should not be the first, to hold that plaintiffs can transform a legal challenge to a factual one merely by alleging that the illegal conduct exception applies. So turning to the UCL claim. The UCL claim fails as a matter of law for a number of reasons, regardless of whether a violation of FARA is plausibly alleged. So first is that the conduct alleged is not a business practice. I don't even think this is a close question. The UCL only allows recovery for unfair, unlawful, or fraudulent business acts or practices. And as the district court correctly noted below, the UCL is a consumer protection law that's not designed to protect most of her parties from the kinds of injuries sustained here. Mosifer has essentially conceded that the practices underlying its claims are political and not commercial. So they admitted below that all of the communications and the publications at issue, none of them proposed commercial transactions. And FARA, they've also admitted, requires registration by persons who are conducting political activity in the U.S. On behalf of foreign principals. The Northern District of California once summarized the unfair competition law as saying that it's historically concerned with wrongful conduct in commercial enterprises designed to draw customers away from a competitor. We don't have that here. We have statements that are made about an entire country and precisely about the political activities of a certain country. That is simply not a business practice.
But my question is why this failure to follow FARA's registration rules, why is the question about whether that's a business practice, not a question of fact that's not really susceptible to motion to dismiss? Isn't that a question of fact?
No, I don't think it is, Your Honor. I think if you look at all the cases that are discussing business practices, they're engaged with commercial activity. And so FARA is designed at registration of political activity. And so political activity, as we all know just from our everyday experience, can have economic consequences. That's often why you hear that elections have consequences, right? Like, depending on an administration that's in power, that can have a consequence for a business. But that doesn't mean that all political activity is therefore a business practice. And that's the only sort of connection that the plaintiffs have tried to draw here. The UCL claim is also legally invalid because FARA contains an absolute bar to private enforcement. And a UCL claim can't be based on an alleged FARA violation. Most of us discussed the Rose case. And that they have misread that case. So Rose involved a statute, the Truth in Savings Act, that had a savings clause. And that savings clause explicitly approved the enforcement of state laws relating to the same subject matter. So Congress expressly left the door open for the operation of state laws that hold banks to standards equivalent to those of the TISA, and that's at page 327. So Rose did not overturn the holding in Almond Hill, that when there's an intent to foreclose private remedies, that can be inferred when the remedial devices in the statute are sufficiently comprehensive, like you have in FARA. You have a very comprehensive enforcement scheme of both civil and criminal penalties. You have enforcement designated explicitly to the Attorney General. And I think it's very telling that most of us cannot cite a single case holding that a FARA violation has been sufficient to base a UCL claim. FARA was passed in 1938. The UCL was passed in 1977 and amended in 1992. So depending on which of those dates you use, that's either 46 or 31 years. And in those multiple decades, it appears that a FARA violation has never been held to be the basis for a UCL claim. So now on the trade libel claim, most of us did not at all address the statute of limitations in their argument, and the claim is clearly time-barred. So the district court correctly noted that the statute of limitations runs from the date plaintiffs knew or should have known that it sustained an injury. It pled in the complaint that it was aware of its injury in mid-2017 and had to take countermeasures, and they specifically pled they had knowledge of articles and posts about Qatar that were, quote, wallpapered across the internet that they believed to be false, and they perceived it was hurting their business. So they believed at that point someone was publishing injurious falsehoods, what they claim are injurious falsehoods about them. So the statute of limitations should have run from that point. But even if you apply the discovery rule, as most of our argues that you should, the district court still correctly found that those claims are time barred. So in 2018, the most of our plaintiffs pled that there was a New York Times article and various other articles in national publications, specifically alleging that Mr. Nader and Mr. Brody were engaged in activities on behalf of the UAE and designed to harm Qatar. They are trying to avoid a statute of limitations bar by saying, well, they didn't plead that they actually read those articles. But they have pled that they were keenly aware of every other news article being published about Qatar because it was hurting their business. And they have not pled how they became aware of the basis for their causes of action, if not for that news article. And in addition, even if they were not actually aware then, that's not the standard. The standard is if a reasonable person would have been on inquiry notice at that point, and they certainly should have been. And then on the merits of the claim, even if it's not time barred, they have failed to allege, and they cannot allege, that any of the statements were specifically about them or even about their industry, about luggage retailers, about travel. The California state law requires that claim for injurious falsehood specifically refer to the plaintiff's product or business and derogate it. The district court cited the Hartford Casualty case, which in turn cited the Blatty versus New York Times case. They admit that not a single one of these statements referred to them or their industry. I'm running out of time. Thank you
very much. We'll hear from Daniel Benson for Elliott Brody. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
It's
fine. For Brody Capital Management.
Well, it's for all the Brody parties. We're jointly representing Mr. Brody, Brody Capital Management, and Sir Sinis. And just to be clear, I'll be addressing the Mosifer appeal and the cross appeal as against Mosifer.
Mr. Benson will be addressing the cross-appeal as it relates to the dismissal of the counterclaims against Cutter.
Very well, thank you.
And thank you. And may it please the Court, Daniel Saunders, on behalf of the Brody parties, I'd like to reserve 1 minute of time for rebuttal. And let me start by following up with what Ms. Forrest said about the Planned Parenthood argument that Mosifer makes and Mr. Larson made. Planned Parenthood, from this Court, dealt only with step two of the anti-SLAPP analysis. That's the reasonable probability prong, where it is the plaintiff's burden to show that the claims have merit. And under Planned Parenthood, this Court just simply said, when you're dealing with that statute in federal court, you have to have parity. That reasonable probability showing is equivalent to a 12B6 showing, and that was to avoid a conflict between state and procedural rules. That had absolutely nothing to do with step one of the anti-SLAPP analysis, where it is not the plaintiff's burden to show anything. That has the burden on the defendant, not the plaintiff, to make a prima facie showing that the speech at issue is constitutionally protected. That doesn't impose a burden on the plaintiff to come forward with evidence. The district court didn't impose a burden on the plaintiff to come forward with evidence. It's the defendant's burden to make the threshold showing that the statute applies. And the California Supreme Court and this court in Safari Club recognized a narrow exception where the plaintiff cannot make that prima facie showing if the defendant has already admitted or there's some uncontroverted evidence that the speech is illegal. So it has nothing to do with the plaintiff making an evidentiary showing or an evidentiary hearing. It's a limited exception that prevents the defendant from invoking the statute and meeting its burden on step one if there is an admission or uncontroverted evidence. Mosifer would effectively have this court overrule Safari Club, which of course one panel of this court can't do, and hold that as long as a plaintiff alleges or plausibly alleges that the speech was illegal, that alone is enough to remove the claims from anti-SLAPP scrutiny. But that has never been the law. It is not the law. They don't cite a single case saying that it is the law. And it's just a lot of smoke and mirrors. But the second reason that Mosifer's argument fails is that even if there were some undisputed evidence of a FARA violation, which there clearly wasn't, that wouldn't affect prong one because a FARA violation does not make the speech at issue illegal. It's the Foreign Agents Registration Act. It's a failure to register. It doesn't prohibit or criminalize any publications or any speech. It simply requires that information be made available to the public so the public can assess that speech in light of the speaker's associations. There is no such thing as illegal speech under FARA. It's not like obscenity or extortion or other speech that has been recognized as unprotected, such as incitement. And the Supreme Court specifically recognized in the Meese versus Keene case in 1987 that FARA, quote, places no burden on protected expression. So again, Mosifer doesn't cite a single authority holding that the illegal speech applies to otherwise constitutionally protected speech based on the speaker's failure to register under FARA. As far as the UCL claim, this is the classic effort to get a square peg into a round hole. It's an unfair competition statute. Mr. Brody doesn't sell luggage. Mr. Brody isn't involved in the travel business. Mr. Brody is not a competitor in any way of Mosifer. Mr. Larson spoke very broadly, and again, I think just trying to confuse the issues about, well, this had impacts on tourism, and that's somehow a business practice. For an unlawful prong UCL claim, it is the alleged unlawful conduct that has to be a business practice. A failure to register under FARA is not, by any means, a business practice. And in response to your question, Judge Thomas, I think that is a question of pure statutory interpretation that is proper for the court to address. And again, the speech itself, which is what Mosifer is complaining about, would not be illegal even if there were a FARA violation. So with respect to Mosifer's appeal, again, there's just not one case that they cite. They have over 120 pages of briefing they've submitted to this court. Not one case in which a court has denied an anti-SLAPP motion at step one based on a mere allegation of illegal conduct. Not one case in which a court has found speech constitutionally unprotected based on a FARA violation. Not one case in which a court has found a FARA violation can serve as the predicate for an unlawful UCL claim. And with respect to this injurious falsehood or trade libel or whatever they want to characterize it as now, not one case in which any court has found that such a cause of action can be based on general political speech about a country or its policies that says nothing whatsoever about the plaintiff. So the district court was clearly acting properly in dismissing Mosifer's complaint. It is a textbook example of the type of complaint that the anti-SLAPP statute was designed to strike in an early stage. It's a complaint that sought to punish American citizens for political speech, taking a stand against Qatar's sponsorship of Hamas and other terrorist organizations, and further sought to enjoin them from any negative speech in the future. Classic, patently unconstitutional prior restraint. The counterclaims, in contrast, focused on protecting the First Amendment rights of U.S. citizens to engage in political speech in the public forum without being targeted and hacked and smeared by a foreign state and its proxies, a state that's not even willing to sue in its own name, but instead perpetrates a fraud on the judicial process through the use of sham proxies. So to the extent the district court sort of took a pox on both your houses approach and got rid of everything, we're nowhere near constitutional parity here, and we're nowhere near parity on the statement of claims. I'll just address briefly, and then I'll save for rebuttal. With respect to the abuse of process counterclaim, the district court apparently misconstrued the word process as used in that claim when it stated that the Brady parties failed to identify any process or act using process that could be the subject of that claim. Process for abuse of process is not limited to a pleading or a complaint or some type of written document in the sense of a process server. It refers to the entire panoply of procedures in the judicial process. And there was clearly sufficient allegations accepted as true in the counterclaims that the Mosifer parties abused that process to achieve an improper purpose, which was specifically to silence and punish American citizens for their political speech while effectively defrauding the court by hiding the real party of interest in order to preserve their sovereign immunity claim. With that, I'll reserve my maybe 30 seconds, or the court will grant me a minute.
We'll give you a minute.
For Obama, I'll turn it over to Mr. Benson.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Benson. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Daniel Benson for the Brody parties. Your Honors, there's been a discussion of the legal technicalities of the anti-SLAPP law and other issues. I think it's plain that, as a matter of law, the claims that Mosifer has brought fail miserably. And I think it's plain that, as a matter of fact, that the complaint makes no sense. It's plain that this is a sham lawsuit that has been brought in order to retaliate against Mr. Brody, who's been a prominent critic of Qatar's support for terrorism, including its support and harboring. We see it on our television screens at this as we speak, harboring of Hamas terrorists. And this retaliation, they retaliated with a hack and smear campaign, and this is, as we allege in our counterclaims against Qatar, this filing of this lawsuit is part of that campaign. Qatar may not be entitled. It would be entirely unfair and unjust to allow Qatar to do what we allege they're doing and what, frankly, it's plain, I think, from the facts that we see in front of us that they're doing, to rely on sovereign immunity here and evade Mr. Brody's right to assert counterclaims against it. The Supreme Court said in the Republic of China case in 1955, and that's the case that Congress codified in the counterclaim exception. We have a foreign government invoking our law, but resisting a claim against it, which would fairly curtail its recovery. It wants our law like any other litigant, but it wants our law free from the claims of justice. Your Honor, this case is actually far worse. Qatar doesn't want our law like any other litigant. It wants to abuse our legal system to wage lawfare with impunity against its critics. Let's step back and look at what's happening here. A luggage store in Manhattan sues a California resident, not because he criticized the store or anything to do with the store, but because he criticized Qatar. Their entire complaint is predicated on criticism of Qatar. And in bringing this case, Mosifer just happened to use information that could only have been gleaned, as we allege, from John Doe lawsuits that Qatar did file through its FARET registered counsel. Of course, John Doe's cannot file counterclaims, and they used those lawsuits to serve subpoenas and obtain information that was used in this complaint. And then it publicized the filing of the complaint to recycle the smear that it had been conducting against Mr. Broidy, and they used Qatar's FARA registered public relations firm to do that. Mossifer's supposed damages, hundreds of millions of dollars on a global scale, whatever that means, are predicated entirely and exclusively on criticism of Qatar. And this is when Qatar's official statistics show that tourism to Qatar was steadily increasing during this period. Qatar argues that the claims could only have been that Mossifer could only bring claims on its own behalf. But that ignores the allegations of the counterclaims and the plain reality staring us in the face. This is a sham lawsuit not to recover any damages suffered by Mossifer. It was filed at Qatar's direction as part of its campaign against Mr. Broidy and other critics of its support for Hamas. Again, Your Honors, Mossifer alleges not that Mr. Broidy or anyone else damaged them directly. Mossifer does not allege that Mr. Broidy said one word about Mossifer, only about Qatar. Mossifer alleges only that Mr. Broidy's criticism of Qatar harmed it. In his counterclaims, Mr. Broidy alleges that Qatar illegally sought to silence and punish him for that very same criticism. Moreover, Qatar alleges, for example, that Mr. Broidy's criticism of Qatar was instigated by Qatar's regional rival, the United Arab Republic, the UAE. As Mr. Broidy, as we allege in our counterclaims, Qatar's hack and smear campaign against him was very similar to and was carried out by the same ex-CIA black ops people who carried out Qatar's global leaks hack and smear campaign against UAE's ambassador to the United States, which was also aimed at deterring and silencing Qatar's critics. There's no question that given Mr. Broidy's allegations, the allegations in the complaint, and again the reality staring us in the face, the claims and counterclaims arise out of the same transaction or occurrence, which the Supreme Court has made clear is a flexible, and other courts have made clear, is a flexible standard, and certainly Congress could not have intended to exclude counterclaims against a country like Qatar. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for reply, if that's okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Zients, yes, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. David Zients on behalf of the State of Qatar. I have three main points that I'd like to cover. First, the counterclaim exception to the FSIA only applies to an action brought by a foreign state, bringing a claim of a foreign state as a matter of plain text. This lawsuit was not brought by a foreign state, and it is not and cannot be advancing the claim of a foreign state. Common law agency principles are not relevant to this exception. Second, even if they were, the complaint does not adequately plead that the Mossifer parties were acting as a common law agent filing a lawsuit on behalf of the State of Qatar. Third, even if this could be treated as an action brought by a foreign state, Broidy's counterclaims don't arise out of the same transaction or occurrence as the claims that were initially brought by Mossifer. Your Honor, turning to the first point, the claim of a foreign, that this has to involve the claim of a foreign state. You heard earlier, I think Mr. Benson was making the point that Mossifer wasn't injured, that there was no relationship between Broidy and Mossifer. Judge Thomas, you asked the question to Mr. Larson earlier, was Mossifer actually, mentioned or targeted specifically? And the answer to that colloquy may well mean that the Mossifer parties don't have a claim. If they want to stand in U.S. court and bring a claim, they need to be injured themselves. They need to meet the elements of the claims, as to them. But it is a fundamental legal impossibility for them to be advancing the claim of the foreign state. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 17 says an action must be prosecuted in the name of the real party in interest. In the district court, Mr. Broidy did not move to dismiss the claim, the most for claims, on the ground that the most for parties were the real parties in interest. Instead, they said the most for parties weren't injured. All of these reasons that you've heard again today. We're not here taking a position one way or the other on that, but they are engaging on the question of whether the MOSIFR parties can bring a claim. This is not a claim of a foreign state, so it can't fall within the exception by its plain text. The plaintiffs have really almost exclusively relied on this court's decision in Sachs, which involves the commercial activity exception and the question of whether commercial activity by an agent is commercial activity carried on by a foreign state in the United States. And you have a fundamental, different type of conduct where an Austrian state railway, it could send an employee to a ticket office in the United States and sell tickets there, or it could engage an agent to sell tickets. The ticket is being sold on behalf of the Austrian State Railway. When it is presented, it is being honored at the Austrian State Railway. It is in every meaningful sense. This is how entities do business through agents when they're selling tickets. That's how the Austrian State Railway was doing it. So it's very natural to say that is commercial activity carried on by the foreign state. The situation with lawsuits is entirely different. It is a legal impossibility for a common law agent to bring an action on behalf of a foreign sovereign. With very limited exceptions, lawsuits have to be brought in the name of the real party in interest. If Mr. Broidy had filed a motion to dismiss saying that the most for parties are not the real party in interest, that could have been a basis for dismissing the case. Fundamentally, unlike commercial activity, it is not possible to engage in litigation through common law agents. Turning, Your Honor, to the question, even if you set that aside, do the alleged common law agency, the restatement of agency, which this court has followed, focuses on direction, control, and this critical question of on behalf of. It is not enough to say, X directed Y's conduct, asked Y to do something, even exercise some degree of control. There has to be assent to acting on behalf of the principal. As we just discussed, it's really not a legal possibility here. But even setting that aside, when you read the complaint cover to cover, the counterclaims cover to cover, you have very long sections talking about personal relationships between families, business connections. Some fairly gratuitous, broad brush criticisms of how power structures work in Qatar. You don't actually have any allegation that goes to direction of the MOSIFR parties, whether directly or through the Abu Issa brothers, in filing this lawsuit, much less assent agreement by either the alleged principal or the alleged agent that a lawsuit would be filed on behalf of the state advancing the claim of the foreign state. Your Honor, the third fundamental problem here, and in some ways it's maybe the most straightforward and doesn't require, on this foreign state question, Mr. Broidy is asking the court to do something unprecedented and treat an action brought not by a foreign state as brought by a foreign state. There's actually a more direct precedent on this question of same transaction or occurrence. I agree it is a liberal standard. It is not a limitless standard. This court has often focused on the essential facts. Do the essential facts of the claims really relate to the essential facts of the counterclaims? Mr. Broidy, in his brief, the main case that he relies on is the Supreme Court decision called Moore versus New York Cotton Exchange. He quotes over and over this one sentence about the one circumstance without which both parties wouldn't have come to the court. The next sentence after that says, essential facts alleged by appellant enter into and constitute in part the cause of action set forth in the counterclaim. There was real factual overlap between the claim that was made and the counterclaim that was then brought. The Second Circuit, applying the counterclaim exception in Kabiri versus Republic of Ghana, did that exact analysis. One of the claims there The court found it involved the same fundamental factual issues about the alleged breach of an employment agreement that led to an eviction dispute. It also led to a breach of contract dispute, but the essential facts were really overlapping. A number of other counterclaims that were brought where the counterclaimant said, well, there's a number of other kind of broader sets of wrongdoing that was alleged in a more general, linked in a more general way to this employment relationship. The Second Circuit said that's not enough. So as liberal as the standard may be, you know, it doesn't cover things that are fundamentally about different factual circumstances. The facts of the one don't really relate to another. Here you have on one hand what the most of her claims are bringing are as a claim of a disinformation conspiracy. You know, whether you know that those claims will go forward or not, we don't take a position on. But they are about, you know, an allegation that Mr. Brody was engaged in disinformation that harmed the most of her company's business. The counterclaims that the Brody parties have now brought against Qatar are about alleged cyber espionage. I can't think of a single fact that would be relevant to litigating the most of her party's claim that would go to the elements of any cause of action that the Brody parties are bringing against Qatar. These are fundamentally two different things: an alleged disinformation conspiracy and alleged actions of cyber espionage. I would just point out, you know, this is I think there is good reason to be cautious about the same transaction or occurrence analysis in the context of the counterclaim exception, where Congress has proceeded carefully and narrowly in making exceptions to the general rule of sovereign immunity for foreign sovereigns, even if, though, we assume that this applies exactly the same way it does in the Rule 13 standard. There's actually real danger in setting aside foreign sovereign immunity, just the way litigation works in a more normal setting, to adopt this kind of limitless, any circumstance that kind of, connects the two parties, even if the claims and the counterclaims don't have any factual overlap. The result of that would mean if you don't bring a counterclaim, that you might have a totally separate dispute with the same person. If you don't bring that counterclaim, it would be treated as compulsory and you would lose that in another action. So the point of this rule is judicial efficiency, and if something is going to be, the same basic set of facts are going to be litigated in one case, they should be litigated. The counterclaim should be litigated too. If you adopted, what the Brody parties are asking for here, totally separate from the consequences for sovereign immunity, it would have real problems for litigation more broadly. Your Honor, I'm happy to yield the rest of my time unless there are questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Larson. You have 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll just make 4 points in rebuttal. First of all, with respect to the anti-SLAPP matter, Mr. Saunders is wrong. The Planned Parenthood case, yes, did extend to step two, but the gun case, which we submitted that just came out this year, made it clear that it applies to both step one and step two. At page 1120, the court wrote, "We now hold that these rules for anti-SLAPP motions to strike apply in federal courts, regardless of whether a plaintiff challenges the first or second step of the anti-SLAPP analysis." This was a legal motion. It was not a factual challenge. Therefore, the court had to accept as true, just as it does in every 12B situation, the factual allegations. We clearly pled that it was illegal conduct. It clearly is illegal conduct, and therefore it was improvident, improper to grant the anti-SLAPP. Second point on the UCL. It is clearly conduct that is subject to the UCL. This is illegal lobbying and public relations, which is designed to disrupt commercial relations, designed to destroy our client's business, designed to strip them of money. This is using a political instrument, lobbying, politics, publications, etc., but for a purpose that is contrary to the UCL and is in violation of federal criminal law. That takes it outside of protected speech. That is clearly aimed at disrupting commercial success of a business. It's also a business practice to take money to make publications. There's no question here that this is a business practice. Counsel is correct that not all political activity equals business, but in this case, this quasi-political activity, this illegal conduct, is designed mind. It is unfair competition. It is wrong. There are may not be any cases which specifically say that FERA is a basis for UCL, but there is no case out there which says that FERA cannot be the basis for UCL. Engaging in that kind of conduct, there's no authority that FERA stands apart from any other statute and can't be used as a UCL predicate. In the context of this...
Time's up. There's just a final point you want to make.
Well, the final point is just on the issue of the statute of limitations with respect to the fraudulent statement claim. That is all wrapped up in the fraudulent concealment that was being perpetuated precisely in violation of the FERA statute. That's a factual issue. This was not the time to decide the statute of limitations. All of this needs discovery. It is a proper subject for a motion for summary judgment, not for a decision at the 12B stage. Reinstate those two claims, overturn the anti-SLAPP, and let this case go forward as it should.
Okay,
thank you, Your Honors.
All right.
Fast on us for the court's indulgence. The gun case that Mr. Larson just referenced was a factual challenge, not a legal one. It has nothing to do with Planned Parenthood. It had nothing to do with the illegal conduct exception. Again, just not relevant to the issues that are before this court. Just briefly addressing the abuse of process counterclaim and the RICO counterclaim, both of which the district court wrongly dismissed. On abuse of process, we cite at least two California cases, the Barquis and Yu case, where the filing of a lawsuit was held to support an abuse of process claim, where the lawsuits were allegedly filed in an improper venue to try to get default judgments. Same thing here. The only difference is that instead of trying to abuse the process through filing in an improper venue, we have the counterclaim defendants trying to abuse the process through filing in the name of improper proxies. In both cases, it's a misuse of the process for an end other than what it was designed to accomplish, which is the gist of the abuse of process tort. On the RICO claim, and I'll ask the court maybe for an additional 30 seconds. Thank you. The district court found that the Brady parties had not adequately pleaded how initiating the lawsuit was tortious or unlawful, and it said we had not provided adequate notice that the issuance of a press release was one of the predicate acts. That's at ER 2627. We believe there are sufficient allegations in the complaint to support that. We've discussed that in our brief, but to the extent that anything was unclear or constituted inadequate notice, that's precisely the kind of thing that can be made clear through amendment. And the Brady parties asked for leave to amend. That leave is supposed to be granted with extreme liberality, and the district court abused its discretion in denying the Brady parties even a single attempt to try to amend its RICO claim or to substitute a claim for RICO conspiracy, both of which were specifically requested. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, first, that counsel mentioned the Cabrera case. That's completely unlike this case, and if anything, shows why this case, why the exception applies here. In that case, an employee of Ghana living in the United States, Ghana had sought to evict an employee of the of its government in the United States from premises that it owned. He sought to bring counterclaims arising from claims that he was tortured while back in Ghana. Everything that the core issue here in the claims, in most of his claims and in the counterclaims, is Cutter's is Mr. Brody's criticism of Cutter and Cutter's retaliation for that. Counsel ignores the allegations of the counterclaims. We are not claiming that Mosifer is bringing claims on behalf of Cutter in the sense that it was asserting these trade, you know, unfair trade claims, for example, on behalf of Cutter. We are asserting, and again, I think it's plain and the inference is clear, that they were bringing it as part of Cutter's campaign to retaliate, a lawfare campaign to retaliate against U.S. citizens exercising their First Amendment rights while remaining free from counterclaims. And this is a road. And if Cutter is allowed to do this, this will provide a roadmap for foreign countries to continue to do this. And it's not justified under the statute, under the FSIA. Council argues that relies heavily in their brief and said today that brought by is important language. Well, it's important, but often plaintiffs, lawyers bring claims on behalf of clients, trustees bring claims on behalf of trusts, guardians bring claims on behalf of others. And finally, just one more, the argument that the same transaction or occurrence it would be limitless under our argument is false. This case is unprecedented because no country, to my knowledge, has tried to do that or has been challenged in doing that. But again, Your Honors, if we're not allowed permitted to assert counterclaims against Qatar under these circumstances, I think it will come back to haunt us and it will damage our First Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We thank all counsel for their arguments today. Very helpful. And this case is now submitted.